On several different occasions, I have had the great pleasure of speaking with an outstanding writer, Tom Clavin. He has been a distinguished reporter for the New York Times for many, many years and the author of a whole host of books. I spoke with him first, I believe, about his fascinating account of the chaotic final hours of American troops in Saigon in his book Last Men Out. Most recently, I spoke with Tom Clavin about his book called Dodge City. And now we, in a sense, return to that same larger canvas to hear the story of one of the most colorful figures from the Old West, Wild Bill. The book is titled Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. And Wild Bill Hickok is one of those figures who looms large in American history and yet is not all that well understood. And so Tom Clavin has done a remarkable job of separating fact from fiction and paints for us a very vivid portrait indeed. And I'm excited to have a few minutes to speak with Mr. Clavin about his marvelous new book, which is published by St. Martin's Press, again titled Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. Tom Clavin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
This is great, great fun, and I really enjoyed the book thoroughly. Let's talk for a moment about that whole matter of separating fact from fiction, from fable, whatever you want to call it. And maybe it would be good for us to first understand just how much legend sprung up around the figure of Wild Bill Hickok and how soon in his life that occurred.
It occurred early on in his life. He was still, a young man, and he became, you could possibly give this accolade, so to speak, to George Custer too. But in the post-Civil War American frontier, Wild Bill Hickok became really the first celebrity, is the best way to put it, because he did have some genuine exploits that had begun before the Civil War. He had some adventures during the Civil War, especially as a Union spy. And after the Civil War, he had engaged in what was considered the first recorded, gunfight, where two men squared off against each other, and the first one drew fastest and shot the straightest, and that was Hickok. And he had other adventures on the Great Plains as a scout for the Union Army and fighting Indians and things like that. But a magazine called Harper's New Monthly, which was very popular, especially to readers back east, did a profile of Bill Hickok. And it really catapulted him into the celebrity range, because even though some of the stories that the reporter related, were either not true or, let's say, maybe embellished or exaggerated, there were some very true stories in there about some of his true adventures. And the combination of the two made Hickok seem like this almost mythical American frontier figure. And he became very famous almost overnight. And he stayed that way to the end of his days. And some of his subsequent adventures were true and were reported on, but his celebrity status took on a life of its own. They started to write these dime store novels about him and stories about him. And there were several newspaper reports that had him dying in Dodge City or in Cheyenne or in a gunfight or someplace else that kept popping up. And Hickok, when he could, would write a letter to the editor of the newspaper. He liked writing letters, and say, "No, I'm not dead. I'm fine. I'm still here." So he became a celebrity. And the more outrageous stories that were told about him, killing 10 men at one time, were the better, because people just were ready to believe that this was some kind of Western superhero.
Right. If someone wants an example of so-called fake news, there's probably no better place to look than some of the publications during Wild Bill Hickok's life.
It's true. Things would pop up and suddenly they'd spread like a prairie fire. I mentioned again that there was one report of him being shot to death in Dodge City, and that was suddenly all over the frontier. Oh, poor Wild Bill Hickok. He's leftist, and it wasn't true. There was a story about his fight with the so-called McCandless gang. Now, there was an incident in which there was a bit of a gun battle and two men died and Hickok survived. But by the time that got, you know, went through several iterations, the story along the frontier was that he had, with just his bare hands and a knife, had single-handedly killed all ten members of the McCandless gang. So yeah, fake news is nothing new.
Right, and this is just the sort of a paragon example of what it is. And obviously, yeah, one can imagine how a given paper would sell out if it had a headline brandishing the huge news, such as Wild Bill having been killed. You write at one point, Wild Bill became bigger than any of the legendary figures that had come before him in the mind of a gullible and impressionable public. And later you say, a public eager for tales of the mysterious and fabulous American West.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really important for us to understand now what that American public was sort of thinking and feeling about this vast expanse known as the Old West, and how a figure like Wild Bill Hickok would, in a sense, play perfectly into that mindset.
Well, he was a distinctive-looking man, and he did go on a lot of adventures in which he was by himself, perhaps, as a scout for the U.S. Army, as a deputy U.S. Marshal. He was a federal marshal who patrolled vast expanses of territory and chasing down Army deserters and stolen horses and things like that. And back in to the East, where most of the reading public was, and that's the only way at that time that people got information was through reading. There were, you know, obviously way before there was television or radio. The West was in some ways a mysterious, thrilling and mysterious place. They didn't know a lot about it. In fact, up until the Civil War, once the area west of the Missouri River was, you know, a lot of times it was dubbed as the Great American Desert. That's what the way people viewed it. A lot of people just didn't know what was between the East Coast and out way out in the Pacific Coast, and then you had this mythical figure like Wild Bill Hickok, who was on a daily basis was in that area, was exploring it, was having these hair-raising adventures and close scrapes and daring escapes as a Union spy, there's a story there where he was discovered by himself. Six Indians attacked him, and he managed to fight them off. One was wounded, four were killed, one escaped. And when that story got around, of course, by the time I got back to the East Coast, he'd fought off a whole tribe of Indians. So there was a lot of room for exaggerations because people were reading about a vast to them unknown area of America that had a lot of mystery and a lot of potential for thrilling adventures.
We're speaking with Tom Clavin about his remarkable new book called Wild Bill: The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. One of the things I appreciate, Mr. Clavin, about your book is that, in a sense, you don't pretend to know more than is possible to know about the details of Wild Bill Hickok's life. And at the same time, it's not that you avoid some of these wild stories that almost certainly are not true, because those very stories are kind of part of the truth of who he was and what he represented. That being said, take us inside the challenge that you confronted in trying to figure out where is the actual truth. What are the stories about Wild Bill Hickok that we can believe, and what are the others that we should sort of set off to the side and view in a different way as fiction fabricated in the moment for whatever reason? How does one, so many years later, come to grips with a challenge like that?
Well, I do, in the book, sort of bring the reader in a little bit from time to time, because there's kind of like three categories of material for the book Wild Bill. One is the material that I could corroborate, meaning that I could find reliable sources that some of which were, you know, Hickok's letters himself. He was a letter writer, thank goodness, to family members, to the woman who eventually became his wife, to others. He wrote letters to the editor of newspapers. And there's also reporting that went on at the time, some of which was indeed accurate. Not everything was embellished or exaggerated. Then there's this, the material that I couldn't use, you know, the outright fabrications, the dime store novel, the comic book-like adventures that he had, in which, you know, the same tale is told over and over again, that just this wasn't true the first time, but just kept getting repeated and exaggerated and getting bigger over time. And then I let the reader know that there are some times when, you know, something falls in the middle. Like, there's a good chance to believe that this is true. There are some doubts about it, and there's a couple of times I let the readers know, I can't tell you this absolutely for certain, especially, from, you know, one example is his activities as a spy for the Union during the Civil War. You know, we know some of his adventures that took place, but some of them, you know, he would talk about later after the war. Were they true or not? We don't know for sure. After all, he was a spy. It wasn't like what he was doing behind enemy lines was being broadcast at the time he was doing it. And I think probably, certainly one of the most vivid examples of trying to separate the truth from fiction has to do with Calamity Jane. Now, you know, popular culture would have it that Calamity Jane and Wild Bill Hickok were lovers. There was a great romance between them. And first of all, that was not true. Calamity Jane, yes, was a real figure and a fascinating figure, and I write about her and all her idiosyncratic glory in the book Wild Bill. But Hickok really couldn't stand Calamity Jane. She was not the girl for him. She told anybody who would listen, of course, that Hickok was infatuated with her, and that, you know, sort of like got solidified in the movie The Plainsman back in the 1930s with Gary Cooper playing Wild Bill and Gene Autry as Calamity Jane. And we also had the movie Doris Day as Calamity Jane. But in fact, that does a disservice to a woman named Agnes Lake, who was actually the love of Hickok's life. She was the only woman that he was truly in love with, and that he ended up marrying. And who knows who she is? You know, if you ask 10 people who's Wild Bill Hickok, immediately they would give some kind of answer—a gunfighter, a scout, a lawman, whatever. You asked who is Agnes Lake, there'd be a total blank. And yet she's a remarkable. She was the only female circus owner in the United States. I mean, she was the rival of Barnum and Bailey and the Ringling Brothers. Her circus had hippos, had elephants, and, you know, big spectacular that was very well known and toured the country. That was the woman, this very independent, lovely businesswoman who Hickok fell in love with, and she fell in love with him, and they eventually got married. So I think being able to tell their story is one of the satisfactions of finding out the true story of Wild Bill Hickok.
Hmm. And we should mention that other colorful figures of the era are also woven into this narrative, figures like Buffalo Bill and Kit Carson and General Custer and so on.
Frank and Jesse James, yeah.
Right, would figure at various points in the colorful life and career of Wild Bill Hickok. One thing that is interesting to me, very early in the book you say that the real story is at least as exciting and fascinating, if not more so, than the legends that have been attributed to Wild Bill Hickok. That seems like a fascinating and maybe unexpected phenomenon, that part of the whole point of fabricating legends is to fabricate something that's even more incredible than what there actually is. But I think you're really pointing to something important here when you say that actually, in a sense, one shouldn't waste one's time with the fabricated legend, because the real story is actually even more riveting.
Yeah, and I first got that strong sense when I was working on my book Dodge City, which came out a couple of years ago, and it's the story of Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson and the city that was known at the time as the wickedest town in the American West. And Dodge City was an example of all kinds of fabrications, and certainly it's true of Wyatt Earp's life. There have been all kinds of exaggerations and embellishments. To his dying day, he kept trying to set the record straight and never quite was successful. Things just started to spring up around him and that he had no control over about his life. And that's a reason why I, after Dodge City was over, I started work on the story of James Butler Hickok, which was his real name, James Butler Hickok, not Bill at all, because it was the same thing. As I found out about Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, the adventures they had, the friendship between them, the gunfights they were in, their work as deputy marshal, deputy sheriff of Ford County, they're real. What you can find out is actually true. It was really quite fascinating and quite exciting, and you could sort of read it guilt-free because you were enjoying it, but you weren't enjoying it wondering, this can't be true. You were enjoying it with the knowledge that, you know, this had been carefully researched and it is true. And that became the same, you know, modus operandi for doing the story of Wild Bill Hickok, that you could, if you get past the exaggerations and the outright fictions, there's still great stories there that he did. And that makes him, I think, even a more fascinating character, because here's a man that really did live some of these adventures. And for the most part, until the very end, of course, he survived them. And only his legend grew, but it for a good reason, because the legend was based on a lot of really true adventures.
Mm. Let's touch on a couple of factors in his life and persona that are not always talked about, or not always explored as extensively as you do so in your book. He was the son of an ardent abolitionist, and he himself was also a fervent abolitionist. And I want you to just say a word about how you think this shaped the man he became and what he ended up representing.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because, yes, his father was very anti-slavery, and their farm in Illinois, as James Butler Hickok was growing up, was a way station on the Underground Railroad. His father actually smuggled, escaped, and runaway slaves farther north to safety. And I think one of the things that young Hickok got out of that was a sense of fighting injustice and fighting, giving people fair play, treating people the way he would like to be treated. All through the rest of his life, he would always side with the underdog, and he hated bullies and people who beat up other people, which was certainly the case with slaves when they would be, you know, abused terribly. And he knew about that. He learned that from a very early age, from talking to them when they were waiting to be transferred to the next place, what some of their experiences were like. And it really did affect his mindset about fairness and injustice for the rest of his life.
He was a spy in the Union Army, and you tell us that he was a productive spy. That, in other words, the what a spy had to do behind enemy lines, in a sense, really tied into some of his most impressive innate gifts and skills.
Yeah, he was a successful spy in the sense that, first of all, he survived, and he was behind enemy lines, often dressed as a Confederate sergeant or an officer, which, upon discovery, would have meant, you know, automatic execution. And he did manage from time to time to emerge from behind enemy lines to supply, you know, the Union officers with valuable information on troop strength and troop positioning. And there's a couple of times that he would become the part of the inner circle of one of the commanding officers, like a Confederate general in Missouri, something like that. And listening to the general talking to his senior officers and about what their strategy is and what they're planning to do and things like that, and then managing to sneak out and get this information across the Union lines to the people who needed to know about it. And he had some very close scrapes. You know, this is one story in the book that he was discovered and put into a cabin with the expectation that they would be taken out at dawn and shot. And he managed to escape, just barely escape, and like a day and a half later find his way to the Union lines. So that is kind of exciting. But I do tell the reader there's some things we don't know about his activities. And I can only tell you what I was able to corroborate, and there's things that have been said about it. I can't guarantee it's true.
Hmm. He kills his first man in 1861 and kills many, many men after that, of course. And you tell us plenty about those sorts of exploits. What can you tell us about his skill with a gun? And in particular, maybe just say a word about how there are actually some rather detailed accounts of what he was like with a gun and what made him so formidable.
Yeah, he discovered as a kid that he had a talent for shooting. First, it was used for hunting to provide the game for the family dinner table, which was very helpful. But he really enjoyed it. I don't mean in a sadistic way, but he did not set out to kill anybody. That wasn't why he became proficient with guns, but just that he knew that guns on the American frontier were a way of protection, and if you're going to protect yourself with a gun, why not be the best you can with it? So he taught himself not only how to shoot with amazing accuracy, but to do so with both hands. So he had. That's why he always wore the two Colts six shooters with the handles out, because he could shoot just as well with the right hand as he could with the left. And so and he always was the last one to engage in a fight. By that I mean he was never an aggressor. He didn't want to initiate any kind of gunfight. But as the book details, there were times in his life where people made it impossible for him to have any other option. And if he did have to resort to it, if he drew his gun, then he did. He shot to kill. You know, he was going to be the fastest and he was going to be the most accurate. And numerous times that saved his life.
I was struck by how detailed some of your descriptions are, not yours specifically, but I mean the detailed accounts that you quote of his appearance, of his physical appearance, and how he often stood out rather spectacularly, even before he'd drawn his gun, just in his appearance, the way he carried himself. And at one point, as you are describing this, you even say that there were ways in which there were actually slightly feminine qualities about his appearance, particularly in terms of how he sort of took care of himself. Could you just say a word about this? I found this absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, you know, there are a number of accounts of people describing his appearance, and one of the things that many of them point out is that he bathed every day. Now, to us, this is not remarkable, but on the American frontier in the 1860s, for example, people went for weeks without bathing, you know, if not longer, and yet he bathed every day, whether it was jumping into a stream or at a town bathhouse. He really took care of himself, how he looked. He had the long, flowing brown hair down and sometimes past his shoulders. He always wore a black sombrero, yellow moccasins, buckskin outfit. So sometimes when he was in town gambling, he'd wear pinstripe pants and a Prince Albert frock with a vest. He was also 6'1", and he had this very slim waist, and some people would refer to his slim waist as almost like a feminine quality. He was not a hard-featured man. He had sort of like a soft-featured face. So there were a couple of descriptions of him that would point to, that would say something like an almost feminine quality. And I don't think that they meant that as anything critical of him at all or questioning his manliness. It's just that I think that they were surprised when they actually encountered Wild Bill Hickok, the famed gunfighter and shootist, and what a term they used back then, man-killer, that they were not encountering somebody who looked like a real tough guy. He was an imposing figure in a lot of ways, but he also had, he had this approachable side to him, and he was always also described too as having a friendly face. So he wasn't this hardened criminal-looking kind of guy.
And you talk about how as his legend grew, this became something of a burden, and he actually in some ways went out of his way to live up to the legend that was building up. And then, of course, some kind of malady begins to affect his eyesight, which in a sense was the beginning of the end. And we, unfortunately, all these years later, have no idea exactly what was going wrong with his eyesight. But that was the worst possible news for somebody in the business in which he was engaged. But in the last couple minutes, I want you to address something you say. When you say Hickok was both the prototype and the first victim of progress on the American frontier, what do you mean by those intriguing words?
Well, he became the prototype of the two-fisted, two-gun lawman on the American frontier, where the justice system was very rough, was still being developed. People were trying to figure out doing jury trials and having judges and things like that. And so, when Hickok especially was the Marshal of Abilene, he basically had, he went with his fists and his guns, he tamed that town. And so so he was that prototype. He was the advance guard, let's say, of trying to bring justice and law and order to the frontier. But then when it took hold, he did not really adapt. It started to get past him. Towns started to hire marshals who were peace officers as opposed to lawmen. And Hickok didn't get a job really after Abilene because he was seen as an old-fashioned kind of frontier lawman. And the towns wanted to embrace the new kind of lawman that put people in jail and found ways other than guns to resolve disputes. So it's kind of like that, plus what you mentioned about his fading eyesight. There's kind of a tragic aspect to Wild Bill Hickok, that he was a celebrity and he was a person who earned and deserved a lot of recognition. but he also was one that the West started to pass him by. And he died at only 39, and yet that was a full life in the sense of all the adventures he had, but also because it didn't seem like the rest of his life, especially with his failing eyesight, was going to be all that enjoyable. So and certainly would be more dangerous.
The book again, Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter, published by St. Martin's Press, the author Tom Clavin. Tom Clavin, you've done it again. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about yet another fascinating book from your pen, and best wishes.
Thank you. It's been a privilege for me.